is an abortion not an abortion when it is infanticide? Now, one might argue that all abortion amounts to infanticide, and I would tend to agree with one who would argue this way, but there is a mode of abortion, at least we call it advisedly abortion, partial birth abortion. If one looks at what happens in this so-called surgical procedure, one begins to wonder whether or not you can even call this an abortion. We're going to talk about that term abortion, whether or not it applies rightly to partial birth abortion, and we're going to talk about a culture that is becoming, as my guest puts it, morally velocitized. We'll find out what he means by that in the course of this hour of Issues, Etc. Is partial birth abortion really abortion? Greg Kokel is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Greg will join us here in just a moment. You can feel free to join us as well. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. And a live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Greg Kokel is our guest. He's president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. He's also written an article on partial birth abortion in the latest Solid Ground newsletter. He's a regular guest. Greg, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, Todd. Are you guys freezing out there in the Midwest?
It is freezing. It's below freezing, in fact.
Snowed in?
Ice.
Oh, I'm glad I'm back out in sunny Southern California right now.
Before we get into the whole term partial birth abortion, whether or not we're really talking about abortion here and why so many people both accept it as just another procedure and defend it, you have written about our culture becoming morally velocitized. What do you mean by that?
Well, many years ago now, when I was in driver's ed, they taught us a concept called being velocitized on the freeway. And basically this is where you get desensitized to the speed that you're going. So when you accelerate from 20 to 60, you feel like you're really moving along until you hold 60 for a couple of minutes, and then it kind of seems like normal. Then you can accelerate from 60 to 80, and 80 seems like really fast until 5 or 10 or 15 minutes of it, and then it seems very normal. And this sense of feeling normal at these high speeds is what they mean by being velocitized. It doesn't feel like you're moving any faster than you were at first, but in fact you are. And, of course, this can be very dangerous on the highway. But it's deadly when it happens to the moral consciousness of a society. Now, years ago, Francis Schaeffer, who had a great impact on my own thinking, I think had a very good, had his finger on the pulse beat of society and where it was going. And he said this. He said, "What was unthinkable yesterday is thinkable today and ordinary and commonplace tomorrow." I mean, Todd, when you just think about how much momentum there is right now to same-sex marriage, for example, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, no one would have ever thought this would be remotely possible that anyone would consider such a thing. But just like Schaeffer said, what was unthinkable yesterday is thinkable today and ordinary and commonplace tomorrow. And so we see a number of different areas in our society where we have become morally velocitized. We have gotten used to what would have been considered in the past a high level of depravity. And so now it seems kind of normal. And so you have to go further out to feel more bizarre in our conduct to feel like we're morally strange. And once we get used to that, this, of course, is ordinary and commonplace, and we have to go further to feel out of step with moral rules and moral principles. And I think that's one of the things that's happening to us here in the 21st century.
It's called D and X. It's called partial birth abortion. Mm-hmm. I imagine there are a couple other euphemisms used for it, sometimes just called a surgical procedure.
Right.
What is it?
Well, it's a procedure that is relatively new. It's called dilation and extraction, or intact dilation and extraction. And it's a type of, and I'm using quotes around the word now, abortion procedure. Basically, there was a different procedure that was problematic, which is called dilation and evacuation, D&E abortion. And this is a late-term procedure where the child's body is dismembered inside of the mother. And I'm using the word child advisedly because this is clearly what you have here in a late-term abortion. The baby's body is dismembered inside the mother, and then the pieces are retrieved. And this is the way the abortion is accomplished at this stage of development. But this, of course, created problems. Maybe you left a body part behind, sepsis set in, a woman got sick, lawsuits, etc. So they figured, well, wait a minute. We can do the same thing without cutting the baby up. Instead of dilating the woman and extracting the parts, or rather evacuating the parts that have been cut up, we can dilate and extract the entire fetus. Not all the way, of course, because you can't bring the baby all the way out of the birth canal, or else then the baby would be protected by law. Instead, we bring the baby 90% out, turn the baby breech, bring it out feet first, and while its head is still in the birth canal and the rest of the body is outside of mom's body, in other words, you have a baby that is partially born, which is why the term partial birth abortion, at least on the partial birth part of that moniker, is an adequate or an accurate description. And at that point, the process is halted. The doctor takes a sharp instrument, generally a Metzenbaum scissors, and pierces the skull of the baby, puts in a catheter, and evacuates or sucks out the brain tissue. The skull collapses. Of course, the baby is no longer squirming anymore. It is now dead, and the delivery is completed, bringing out a dead child. This is called dilation and extraction, DNX abortion, or partial birth abortion.
One of the things that strikes me, and I don't want to get too far afield on this, but both of the terms for a, kind of the traditional surgical abortion, dilation and evacuation, and dilation and extraction, as it is used to describe what we commonly call partial birth abortion,
right,
both of those terms leave out the most crucial event that takes place in this procedure, and that is the extermination of the baby.
That's right.
They're talking about what's being done to the woman and the, kind of the location of the child, mm-hmm, but they're not. But it almost glaringly omits the fact that the child is killed in the process.
Yeah, well, that's true in all descriptions of abortion procedures. You could have a saline abortion. You could have a dilation and curettage, a DNC at early stages, and all of these are just meant to describe the procedure in fairly clinical terms. And of course, as you point out, they insulate us from the harsh reality that what is going on here is the snuffing out of an infant's life. And, of course, this is why, you know, partial birth abortion is a term that is popularly used because it adequately describes, at least in the partial birth portion of that statement, what goes on there. But it too adequately describes what actually is going on. There is too much of a personal element in the partial birth part of that phrase, so that those who are pro-abortion are very offended by this use of the term and therefore want to go back to the more sterile technical terms, DNE or DNX rather, and therefore cover up what's actually going on. So this is why you'll often see in articles, Todd, when it talks about this, that, well, partial birth abortion isn't even the medical term. Well, so what? Neither is, you know, lopping off somebody's head the medical term that might be substituted for that kind of thing, but it still amounts to the same thing, you know, an execution of that individual. So this is just a way of getting away from the ugliness of what's actually going on.
Your concern goes even farther than that, and that is really the subject of the article that you
right.
wrote for Solid Ground Newsletter. You question whether or not partial birth abortion should even rightly be called abortion.
Right, and the question I ask at the end of the article is simply this, Todd. How much of the baby's body has to remain inside the mother for it to be called an abortion? You know, the point I make it is that, you know, you've got this statement that people make about the ostrich. You know, the ostrich sticks its head in the sand. And this is an illustration used to discredit someone who won't see the obvious. The fool who, like the ostrich, thinks that the real world is defined by where his head is located. That's the key here for my point. Because those defending partial birth abortion treat the child like the ostrich. His head is obscured. So it's as if the rest of the world doesn't exist. And I'm asking how far does such reasoning go? I mean, how much of a newborn's body has to be inside the mother to justify killing him? The baby's arm, his little fist, why not just one finger? I mean, where do you draw the line here? It just seems to me quite obvious, and we've discussed this before, that the location of the baby, in the mother or outside of the mother, has no relevance to the baby's value. However, the law makes this arbitrary distinction, such that baby inside mom, you can kill, baby outside mom, you can't. Okay, so now you got baby half and half. And I think that what we have here, quite obviously, is not abortion. This isn't the taking of the life of a child inside mom. This is infanticide because it's taking the life of a child whose head is simply covered, incidentally, by part of mom's body, but this is seems to be irrelevant to the moral question. And I think somebody could well ask, look, if it's okay to kill a baby through partial birth abortion, why the technicality of the head being in the birth canal after all? I mean, this pauses the birth process. It's painful. It's difficult. It might be medically harmful to the woman. Why don't we just let her expel the baby? And I think we're well on the way to this move, by the way, the next step. The safest late-term abortion technique yet, deliver the child completely, then harvest the organs, and, of course, you'll never call it infanticide. You call it a postnatal abortion. And this gives you an idea of what's going on here with the word games.
Now, all abortion, to my mind, regardless, is infanticide. But we're talking here about not letting pro-abortion forces either get away with misdescribing this or hide behind the term abortion because, of course, it's commonly believed that abortion is a sacred right.
Right, right. Well, I guess what you just stated there, all I can say is amen to that. We are trying to flush this out in the open, and we are trying to make clear what's going on. And there's an interesting little play going on here because in partial birth abortion, you have a baby kind of straddling a line, so to speak. Are they in? Are they out? Are they halfway? Whatever. And so what the decision that we make about partial birth abortion, frankly, I think the people have spoken, the Congress and the Senate have spoken, the President has spoken on this. Now this is in the hands of the Supreme Court. But the decision they make will be very telling because if they decide that that partial birth abortion is an appropriate way of dealing with the problem of an unwanted pregnancy, it's going to be very difficult for them to argue that the baby's head popping out of the birth canal somehow magically turns this child into a formless and valueless tissue mass into a valuable human being. It's just another 2 inches over. The movement is irrelevant. Now, if that's the case, then if partial birth abortion is okay, according to the courts, and it's de facto the same thing, morally speaking, as if the baby were all the way out of mom, out of the birth canal, and killing it, then there is no reason not to justify infanticide by the same line of reasoning. However, if it turns out that we say that partial birth abortion is hideous, it's morally obscene, that we ought not do this to living human beings, then the same reasoning drifts back the other direction. Just back the child up a couple of inches, and if it's wrong with the baby partially outside of the mother's womb, how could it be right simply in virtue of the fact that the baby is now entirely covered by mom? And if people see that, then it's going to cast a moral aspersions on abortion itself. And this is why this issue is so important. Because if we say partial birth abortion is illicit, it's going to be hard for pro-abortionists to defend any late-term abortion for the same reasons that partial birth abortion is illicit. The difference in this case is that we can see the baby. When the procedure is described, which it must be for somebody to talk about what a partial birth abortion is, people can envision exactly what's happening. And I don't know about you, Todd, but the times that I've seen a child delivered live. It is such a moving experience. It moves me to tears.
Mm-hmm.
It's a miracle. You know, it's just profound. It's so deep and touching. And to think, when we think about partial birth abortion, that the child in the midst of this entry into the world is being immediately executed by having his skull pierced and his brains sucked out, is so offensive to us. We can picture this. It's not hidden away, like DNX and DNC and DNE. I'm sorry, like DNE and the saline and all those other kinds of abortions. Then we are moved. Our moral intuitions come to the surface, and we see how terrible this thing is. This is why, by the way, there has been a move in our favor across the board in the population of the United States regarding the abortion issue in general since the partial birth abortion debate, because people have seen now, in picturing the partial birth abortion procedure, what's at stake, and I think they rightly reason that if this is as heinous as it seems to be, it seems no less heinous a couple of days prior or just before the delivery, simply because the baby's covered now by the mother's womb. And this is what the pro-aborts fear, this understanding of what actually is going on.
Tell us the story, and she's told her own story, in fact, but tell us the story of Corrine Costello.
Well, Corrine Costello is a name that came up about 4 or 5 years ago. She's actually from Southern California, I think, from my wife's hometown, who had a partial birth abortion, and she was trotted out by then President Clinton as a reason why we couldn't make this particular procedure illegal. And she had a partial birth abortion midway through her third trimester. This is pretty late. And in her testimony before the Senate, she said, and listen to the way she puts it here, and I'm quoting, "Our darling little girl was going to die." Apparently the baby had a lethal neurological disorder, and therefore Mrs. Costello, who identifies herself as a Christian pro-lifer, chose a partial birth abortion. And what's important is to not miss the argument here, Todd. Corrine Costello had to kill her child because she, the child, was severely handicapped and was going to die anyway. That's the argument. In fact, we know Costello understood that this was her child because she referred to her, quote, little girl by name, Catherine Grace. So it's clear that in Costello's mind, she was not justifying abortion. She wasn't killing a tissue mass that, you know, that wasn't a human being. She was, by her own admission, taking the life of her little girl named Catherine Grace. She was justifying infanticide. And as I listened during that time to different radio discussions about this issue, both women that I heard in radio discussions said that they held their babies, these are women who had partial birth abortions, they held their babies and sang to them after their partial birth abortions. And my question is, why would a mother gently cuddle the dead body of her aborted child? I mean, she's not going to cradle her tonsils, you know, after they're removed. She's not going to sing to them. She's not going to name her spleen after it's been surgically removed from her body. Well, it's different, they're going to say. What's different? This is not my tonsils. It's not my spleen. It is my baby. And these responses from the mothers themselves are tacit admissions that these children were full human beings at the time of their interrupted births. And if a baby's body is a human corpse after the abortion, then how can one deny that the baby was a human child before he was killed? So even in the mother's own words and actions prove they know that they've taken the life of a fully human child. That means DNX is not abortion. It's infanticide.
We have about 2 minutes here, Greg. The question, of course, is raised here, if not what these women did, somehow in the name of loving their children, how ought we treat physically imperfect children who will die soon after birth?
I think we should just give them the care that they need while they're alive and then let them die in due course. I mean, it doesn't follow, Todd, that if the baby is going to die anyway, it's okay for us to kill them before they die naturally. Look, everybody dies anyway. Todd, you and I are going to die anyway, sooner or later. There is no justification for taking these lives. If they die, then they die. But there is a moral difference between allowing a child to die from natural causes. I mean, I feel silly making this distinction, Todd, but let me just say it plainly. There is a moral distinction between letting a human being die of natural causes and taking that life of that human being before the natural causes run their course. What could be more obvious? That a baby is going to die anyway is not in any whit a justification for taking that life, the life of that child. It just isn't. It doesn't make any sense at all. But this is the kind of rationale they offer. And it's clear they think this is their baby. They cuddle it. They sing it. They name the baby, which is appropriate because it's their baby. Yet at the same time, they think they are justified in taking the life of this child. And this is barbarism.
It sounds as though none of the standard boilerplate justifications for abortion really work for someone who wants to try and justify partial birth abortion. You can't talk about a woman's health because a woman who can bring a child to term to be killed could bring a child to term to live.
Yeah, you offered up for adoption.
It's not an issue of privacy because the woman is saying, this is my baby, kind of a thing.
Right, right.
So how, with 1 minute before we go, how do the tactics, give us a little preview of our conversation on the other side of the break, how have the tactics shifted?
Well, they've shifted subtly but very clearly to making the kinds of defenses that one would make for infanticide rather than the kinds of defenses that are classically made with regards to abortion. For abortion, people said, look, it's my choice, it's my right, it's a privacy thing, that's the end of it, leave me alone. Now they seem to think that they need to say more. They need to give a stronger, a different kind of justification, and of course they do because this isn't a regular abortion.
Greg Kokel is our guest. The question we're answering is partial birth abortion really abortion, or should we call it what it is, infanticide, plain and simple and as horrific as it sounds? Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, and he's also written an article on partial birth abortion in the latest Solid Ground newsletter. Now, if you'd like to check out the website for Stand to Reason, go first to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the section we have there titled Links with Regular Guests, if you scroll down, click on that and scroll down, you'll find Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter, call Stand to Reason. It's an easy-to-remember toll-free number, 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-R-E-A-S-O-N. All right. Now, if you could get through the first 25 minutes of that conversation with the graphic description of what partial birth abortion, and now I hope you're putting your air quotes around the term abortion, partial birth infanticide, and we could just as well call other forms of abortion infanticide as well. It's just the difference of where the baby's located. You know the point of this is? At least one of the points that you should take away from this first 25 minutes? There are going to be all sorts of arguments made based upon location of this little person. Well, if they're in the womb, they must not be a viable life. Or if they're partly in the womb, they're still a candidate for execution. Location is irrelevant to personhood. Location is irrelevant to whether or not the baby in the womb deserves the protection of the law. We'll be right back with Greg Kokel.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The psalmist writes in the 44th Psalm, "Awake, O Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression?" Have you ever felt a little like the psalmist? That God had become your enemy? You'll find an in-depth study of the complaint psalms in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, titled When God Becomes My Enemy. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on this book, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $19.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Is it a sin to complain to God? And if God is omniscient, can he be persuaded to change his course of action? Find out with the book, When God Becomes My Enemy, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute urges you to keep praying for North Africa, where hope exists for large gospel breakthroughs. Churches are continuing growth in North Africa. In the country of Algeria, there are 13 churches which now have the legal status with the government. A report from Arab World Ministries says the number of Christians in Algeria is now estimated at 50,000. Meanwhile, there are a few dozen worshiping house church congregations in another North African country. Continue praying for news of Christ's love to reach people in North Africa. Pray especially that Christians will have freedom and not be threatened by local governments. Finally, pray for believers who are taking great personal risk to have courage and deep love for Christ. Get news from around the world so you can pray effectively by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Have you noticed how much we speak about God rather than to God? Sermons, Bible studies, testimonies of believers, all about what God has done. To put it grammatically, we talk about God in the third person, the same impersonal way we talk about the weather, taxes, what have you. So I found it strange years ago when I began reading St. Augustine's Confessions for the very first time. He begins, "Great art thou, O Lord, and greatly to be praised. Great is thy power, and thy wisdom infinite, and man wants to praise you, man who is only a small portion of what you have created." And on Augustine goes, second person, talking directly to God. I'm not thinking now about prayer, about intentional times of talking to God, but rather about those times when we are thinking whatever we happen to be thinking. I have put myself under the mild discipline of phrasing those quiet, usually humdrum thoughts in the second person, directly to God. The result of that little grammatical recasting of my mundane thoughts has been a tremendous advance in my spiritual life. I know His presence more than when I put Him off in the third person. Try it. He'll like
it. Pastor John Lukomsky was little Johnny Lukomsky. He watched Saturday morning cartoons, but now that he's a mature adult, he plays on the radio. Hi, this is Paul Clayton. You've got to hear Wrestling with the Basics with Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky. It's kind of a fun approach to a Bible study. We guarantee you will learn something and take something with you from Wrestling with the Basics, Saturday mornings at 9:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Is partial birth abortion really abortion? It's the question that we're dealing with Greg Kokel during this hour of the program. If you'd like to join us, we have a live in-studio email address. You can email us with questions or comments. Feel free to do so. That address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here it is one more time, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Also, our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Greg Kokel is our guest. Greg, we touched on this briefly before the break. The standard justifications for abortion simply do not work when it comes to so-called partial birth abortion. You said the tactics change from arguments favoring abortion, like right to choose, my body,
right,
leave me alone kind of arguments, to arguments that would favor infanticide in any form. What do they look like? What do these justifications sound like?
Well, keep in mind, part of my point here is that there is a moral quality to partial birth abortion that it seems to me self-evident. And this is why Congresswoman Pat Schroeder didn't want line drawings even displayed in Congress in the early debates, because even the most benign characterizations of partial birth abortion are enough to make one nauseous when you think about what's going on. And yet this is called abortion, and my point is that simply calling a procedure an abortion doesn't make it one. Your language can change perception, but it doesn't change reality. What we have here, I think, de facto, is a infanticide with the baby's head covered. I think these people know this, and this is why we've seen A change, as you mentioned, in the tactics. The standard justifications, a woman's right to privacy or right to choose, this isn't going to work. So they switched to arguments traditionally used to defend euthanasia. Now, think about it. Since Roe versus Wade in 1973, the courts have spoken very clearly on this. They have not allowed any meaningful restriction on any kind of real, genuine abortion. Abortion is a matter of privacy and choice, and that's the end of the argument. Now, if partial birth abortion is really abortion, then why any further defense or justification? And the reason is that if the same action taken on the same baby at the same stage of development would be a felony, homicide, if the child moved a mere 3 inches further down the birth canal. And so what we have here now is we've got these arguments that emphasize principally the anguish that the mother has to go through in making this difficult decision. I mean, everybody knows what's going on. The mother knows, the doctors and nurses know, the pro-abortionists know. And you can listen to these heart-rending personal anecdotes by anguished moms who desperately wanted their babies, but something went wrong. And so we then get moved with emotion, and we can see, gee, I can understand their decision. I do the same thing myself. Of course, this isn't proper moral reasoning. This is manipulation of one's emotions to keep you, you're identifying with the plight of the woman, but it keeps you from looking carefully at the act itself. And to kind of put a point on this, I ran into an article. Now, this is going to be stunning where this came from. Glamour magazine, September 2003. That was just 4 months ago. Okay? The title of the article is this: Are You Ready to Really Understand Abortion? And then the subtitle: At a handful of clinics that call themselves the November Gang, patients grapple openly with their feelings about having an abortion. To fully understand this politically embattled procedure, every woman should spend a day inside these walls. Enter here. What's this about? Well, they want you to really understand it. What do you mean understand it? We want you to feel the feelings of the women who have to go through abortion. Well, what's unique about the November Gang? If you go into one of the abortion clinics that, like the Allegheny Reproductive Health Center near Pittsburgh, you're going to see a hallway lined with pink hearts with notes written on them. What are these? I mean, hundreds of them. Well, these are notes, listen, written by mothers to their children who they are about to kill. And this is because there is such a powerful emotional impact against the woman when she takes the life of the child she knows is her child. This is to help her work out her feelings. And the article is offered as kind of an apologetic for abortion. In other words, see how much they anguish over making this decision. Surely you can't blame this woman. You can't hold them responsible. You don't want to deny them this liberty because look at how much struggle they went through in order to make the decision. If I have a moment, I'd be glad to read a couple of these little notes I've written.
Before you do that, let's just make it clear here that this is a mechanism that's being promoted by abortion clinics?
Yes. It's called a handful of clinics call themselves the November Gang. And the ones that I have in front of me that are featured in this article in Glamour magazine from September of 2003 features the Allegheny Reproductive Health Center, which is an abortion clinic in Pittsburgh.
Read a few there, Greg.
All right. Here from Mom: I love you, even though I know in my heart I can't keep you, but the memory of you will make me strong. I know your spirit is in a better place. Each tear I cry will help me erase the memory of this day. But not of you. You will always be a part of me, even though you are not here with me. All my love, the mother you'll never meet, but I'm sure you know who I am. Here's another one. To my little angel, please understand that you are better off in the hands of God than mine at this moment. You are and forever will be beautiful and pure. I smile when I think of you, even if I cry. You have given me reason to be strong and wise and responsible. You will always be my baby. I will see you in heaven, sweetheart. I love you. Now, these are obviously quite poignant. And if these were letters written about a child who has been taken through some tragic accident, it would move our hearts to tears. But this isn't the situation here. And the unfortunate thing is our hearts are moved in sympathy to the mother, even though the mother is the author of the act that takes the life of the child. And I want you to consider for a moment, Todd, just this circumstance. Let's just say that I took my 7-year-old son out into an abandoned field, and I wrapped a rope around his neck, And then I leaned over and I said to him, let me see if I find these words here. Okay, here it is. You are my little angel. Please understand that you are better off in the hands of God than mine at this moment. You are beautiful and pure. You will always be my baby. I'll see you in heaven, sweetheart. I love you. And then tightened the noose. Do you see that this is the stuff of bad B-movies? If a person were really to utter that thing under those circumstances, instead of sounding poignant and touching, it would sound twisted, distorted, and despicably evil. How could anyone say, I'll see you in heaven, you're better off with God than with me, and then tighten the noose and strangle their children? But this is precisely what is going on here when these women let the doctor do the same thing but write this letter to their children.
There's also an element here that I'm sure does not escape your notice, Greg, of false hope being given these women as though they could, with their future tears, erase the memory of that day, or that they will reach a point where they'll smile even though they cry in memory of the child that they killed. Mm-hmm. The statistics tend to bear out the fact that women are traumatized by the abortion for years afterwards and suffer from tremendous guilt and seldom come to grips with it in this kind of happy, I'll cry although I smile kind of a way.
You know, you're absolutely right. In fact, this is one of the odd things about this article. It bears testimony to something that the pro-abortion side has been denying for a long time, post-traumatic stress syndrome related to abortions. And I'm looking at some other things, women speaking here. I've been having a hard time for the last 9 months since my abortion. Recently, my brother said, I don't know what's wrong, but if you don't want to talk about it, I will wait for you. And I took him seriously. I've been reading books and trying to talk about it with friends on a post-abortion website. It's been making me feel a little bit better, and I don't want this to affect the rest of my life. Here's another one. It says, 4 years ago, I couldn't even talk about any of this. I couldn't even say the word abortion out loud. It took me 15 minutes to type it into my support group's online message. Then I erased it. I typed it again, erased it, and typed it again, and erased it. You know, why are these women responding these ways? They're recording this. It's because they know that what they did was terribly wrong. Get this little note that somebody put up, and this was to the other mothers who come in the clinic. In block letters, even if it doesn't feel right, doesn't mean it's wrong. Do you see what she's saying? I know, ladies, you're all sitting in here feeling awful, like what you're doing is something terrible. But I'm going to try to talk you into the fact that even in spite of all your intuitions to the contrary, this is still a fine thing to do under the circumstances. See, we know better. They know better. This whole article is helping us to understand the grief that women go through when they kill their children. And then, oddly, asking us to take that as a justification for the act itself.
I have a hard time saying, you know, I would hardly have expected, although they might have tried this, in the Nuremberg trials, the various butchers and slaughterers among the Nazis to say, but look, I kept a journal about how anguished I was every night over the people that I gassed, or the people that I burned, or the people that I experimented on. Can't you take into account the fact that I had moral anguish over doing these things?
Well, this you're right. I mean, when you put it in that context, it sounds so bizarre. Or when you put it in the context that I gave in the illustration with the same language this woman was using, but just with a six-year-old boy. But we've been morally velocitized, and that's the point. What was unthinkable yesterday is thinkable today and ordinary and commonplace tomorrow.
Greg Kokel is our guest. Is partial birth abortion really abortion? Answering that question during this hour. He is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. He's also written an article on partial birth abortion in the latest Solid Ground newsletter. Now, if you'd like to receive Stand to Reason's free Solid Ground newsletter, call that number I gave you before, 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON, or you can check out the website for Stand to Reason by going first to our website, issuesetc.org, and under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Another, you mentioned how the justification for partial birth abortion begins to sound an awful lot like the justification for euthanasia, for any kind of killing where we're taking an innocent life. And you mentioned in the article Judith Jarvis Thompson, who has crafted a very clever justification for partial birth abortion, and I guess it would work for euthanasia as well, involving the violinists. give us her justification and respond to it.
Yeah, this is a fairly well-known piece that she's written actually in 1971. It was before the Roe v. Wade decision. That it isn't a justification for partial birth abortion per se, but it serves to justify all types of abortion. And although, you know, now I think about it, when you hear the details of it, you'll see that you wonder if it would apply completely to partial birth abortion. But in any event, here's her argument. And it's gotten a lot of play by pro-abortionists. She says, first, she accepts the full humanity and full personhood of the unborn from the time of conception, for the sake of argument. She said, okay, I'm going to grant you pretty much all of your argument, but it's still legitimate to take the life of the child during an abortion, and let me through an abortion, and let me tell you why. Let's just say you were kidnapped, and you woke up and you found yourself in a life support system attached to a world famous violinist, and it was necessary for you to be so attached in order to keep that violinist alive. Now, it wouldn't be a permanent arrangement. It would just be 9 months long. And after that, he would survive and be detached from you, and then that would be fine. And she asked the question, would a person who is kidnapped like that and against her consent be attached to a world-famous violinist, some other human being who depended upon her for a life support system, would she be justified in disconnecting from that violinist and claiming her freedom? And Thompson says it would be a great kindness for her to be willing to go throughout the 9 months and help this violinist, but she has no moral obligation to do so. By parallel, and this is an argument by parallel, also called a logical slippery slope in this case, a pregnancy, unplanned pregnancy, is similar to this illustration she offers in a morally relevant way, that a woman, against her will, finds herself surgically attached to another human being who needs her for its life over the next 9 months, after which she will no longer be surgically attached. And if it seems reasonable that, under the circumstance of the violinist, the woman could separate herself, even if it causes the death of the violinist, which it would, according to the way this story is set up, then it would also be the case that if she separated herself from the unborn in her womb through abortion, she would also be justified for the same reasons. Now, this is a very compelling argument, and I remember the first time that I heard it, I was just getting on the ramp to the freeway on the 405 here in the Torrance area of Southern California. I mean, it was very powerful, and I almost had to pull over. I thought, boy, that's really something. Now, I've since changed my view on that because I thought it through a little bit, and I've written a piece called Unstringing the Violinist that can be found on our website. But basically, there's a fairly simple answer to this. The only reason that Thompson's argument sounds compelling is if there is a morally relevant similarity between the violinist and the unborn child. And the answer to that is there is no morally relevant similarity because, and here's the reason, we have different obligations to our own offspring than we do to strangers. Let me say it again. We have different obligations to our own offspring than we do to strangers. Listen, any mother knows that after 9 months, her obligation, even though she is not surgically connected to her child anymore, her obligation does not end. Her obligation is just beginning, and it continues on for about 18 years, and lately, well into the 20s. You know, that mother has an obligation to that child at both sides of birth, prenatal and postnatal, up to 18 years old, because she's mom. An obligation that she has towards her children that is not sustained towards strangers who she might be surgically connected to.
The illustration also pits mother against child makes the child enemy.
Yes, the child is the encroacher, the trespasser. There's another writer who has written a piece along the similar line called Eileen McDonough. And her book is called From Choice to Consent, and she emphasizes this consent thing, and she puts it in starker terms. The child in the womb is attacking the mother's body. The mother has the right to use lethal force to repel it, just like a rapist. Now, this implies that in both cases, that the child is a trespasser, much like the rapist is a trespasser for McDonough, or the violinist is a trespasser in the first illustration. But is the baby a trespasser? A trespasser is somebody who is someplace where they're not supposed to be. Where else is the baby supposed to be? The baby didn't come in from the outside. The baby is being created by the human body and sustained by the human body. It allegedly is trespassing in. This is where the baby belongs. This is the only place babies are to be. And ironically, that place where the baby belongs, the womb of his or her mother, is the most dangerous place for a child to be in this country, because something like 25% of them don't survive and rather they die at the hands of their own mother instead of being born.
Let's go to the phones. Jim is calling from his car. Jim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate the dialogue, but I would caution, remember that logic and reason is not something that's employed by our courts today. And this is not an issue of knowledge, you know, supplying them with the knowledge of the truth of what's actually going on. This is an issue of will. And the court, in a case, I believe, in 1993 in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, said that even though Roe was bad law, mm-hmm. that because it's been in place for 20 years, that now it's the reliance of what our culture and women are relying on, that and is the case of their rights or liberty.
Right.
I mean, this is what the court has said.
Right.
Well, we have to remember that the battle is not about being able to equip the people with knowledge and understanding, but that we have a court that isn't, if we convince 99% of the people in this country, we still have a court where it's an issue of will. And the next president of this United States is going to have the ability to place three justices on that bench.
Mm-hmm. Jim,
and
thank you.
Very important.
Jim, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I agree in principle, but I think you've only got a piece of the picture. If, in fact, we do persuade 99% of the people on our point of view, there'll be almost no abortions in this country, even if the law never changes. There's a two-pronged attack here. We are using, if you want to use the term logic and reason, I mean, I think we're crafting careful arguments to try to figure out what is the right thing to do in the circumstance, and ours is a persuasive enterprise. We want to persuade lawmakers and individuals who may choose an abortion or aid and abet one. And if we can persuade the people who aid and abet them or choose them not to have them, then it doesn't matter what the lawmakers decide at all. Now, of course, there are always going to be some people who aren't going to do the right thing no matter what, and that's when the law comes in and forces them to do the right thing when that right thing is morally weighty enough, and certainly the health of children in this case is an example of that. So I'm saying both and here, and I think Jim's comment, observation, though a good one, betrays maybe an over-reliance on the courts to solve the problem when our goal is to train individuals to persuade other people not to do these things, whether they're legal or not.
Greg, you write near the end of your article, kind of coming back to joining together the two themes. One is partial birth abortion, really abortion, and this kind of slippery slope that slides either way.
Yeah.
You say when you start with the view that abortion is a sacred right, then by reason of a logical slippery slope, you must argue for anything called abortion. What's your point here?
Well, this is where the terminology is, I think, is being used in a manipulative fashion. There is a dependency here on the force of the word abortion in our culture now today. I mean, a lot of people don't like abortion, okay? They want this problem to go away, but they are not willing to outlaw it, even though in many cases they think it takes the life of an innocent human child. So that we have a significant portion of the population that turns out to be pro-choice with regards to the law. And so playing on that, since they are pro-choice with regards to abortion, as procedures get more and more extreme and approximate more and more what is de facto infanticide, the ploy then is to continue to use the word that has worked so well in the past to continue to describe these things, because after all, abortion is protected. So So if we call this an abortion, fine. And this is why I suggested it could very easily get to the point where we just practice infanticide and simply call it a postnatal abortion, because this connotation word now, abortion, is doing all the work for us. Instead of just looking at what's going on, that would be infanticide, that's wrong. No, it's an abortion. Oh, okay, that's fine. And I think this is what's happening, this connotation word name gain, word rhetoric play, smoke and mirrors thing is happening with the term partial birth abortion. Not that the partial birth part isn't accurate. If anything's inaccurate about this term partial birth abortion, it is the term abortion. And this is what gives it its currency. If we didn't call this abortion, if we called it what it is, infanticide with the baby's head covered, there would be very little resistance to outlawing it by the masses. But since we call it abortion, there is that rhetorical move that causes us to resist. We think, wait a minute, if we outlaw this abortion, then what about the other abortions? They'll be in question too. And so it's a very clever use of language, but it is part of what we're up against.
Greg Kokel, thank you very much for your good work, thinking on this subject, and thanks for being our guest.
It's great talking with you, Todd. Thanks.
Greg Kokel, president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. He's also written an article on partial birth abortion in the latest Solid Ground newsletter. Now, if you'd like to have a cassette copy of this broadcast with Greg Kokel on partial birth abortion for a cost of $6.50, or if you'd like to join our new monthly giving program called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, call our resource line 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The first task here, beyond providing proper knowledge, swaying hearts, and of course, we do have to look toward those who make these decisions at the judicial level. The first task here is defining terms. And the task of defining terms is always a task of requiring that people be honest, that euphemisms not cover up great evil, and that even when those who are opposed to great evil oppose it, that they accurately describe what it is they are opposing. We have learned as human beings, haven't we, to hide so well behind the way we use words. And maybe the first thing we should call for in the abortion debate is a little honesty and a little honesty with the words we use. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.